Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth and Movies. I'm Michael Leader.
I'm David Jenkins.
And I'm Lillian Crawford.
On the show this week, one of the year's best and longest films, Ryosuke Hamaguchi's Drive My Car, one of the year's best and shortest films, Celine Sciamma's Petite Maman, and in Film Club, There's Something Strange in the Neighbourhood, it's the original 1984 Ghostbusters. All coming up on Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Yes, welcome back, listeners. Welcome back, David. Welcome back, Lillian. Lillian, since you were on the podcast last, you've had some big life changes. You've moved, right?
Yeah, I've moved to Salford. I'm working on University Challenge now. Doing the picture and music questions is sort of my main task. Putting lots of good films into the quiz. It's been a lot of fun.
I mean, that is, for many of us sort of film nerd pub quiz types, an absolute dream gig.
Yeah, no, it is for me, certainly, because I was on the show a few years ago, and I found the whole experience quite terrifying, and working behind the camera is much more my thing.
Yeah, well, wish you all the best with it, and always good to hear someone moving to Salford. We've mentioned Salford a few times recently, home of Mike Lee as well as me.
I need to go to home and see Naked while it's on.
Well, Naked, you know, it's about someone scarpering from Manchester all the way back down south. So,
yeah.
maybe fitting, I don't know. But talking about Manchester to London, that's quite a car journey. Of course, one of our lead films this week, Drive My Car, has a lot of driving in. Perfect tie in there. But David, before we kick off the new releases, any news from Little White Lies Towers?
No, just reiterating what I was saying last week about our new issue being on the shelves, and I would be eternally grateful if you went and picked it up at your nearest retailer, or you can do it through our website, and you could have a little enjoyable read about all the films coming out in November, December. And, you know, maybe even if you're considering Christmas gifts to some discerning relative, some rarefied soul in your family who you can't think of what to buy. Consider a Little White Lies subscription, because we've got some hot stuff coming in the next year.
Very exciting. Also exciting is the fact that we have probably two of the best films of the year to review this week as new releases, so we should kick off pretty quickly. Let's start with Ryosuke Hamaguchi's Drive My Car. Here's a bit of setup for Drive My Car. 2 years after his wife's unexpected death, Yusuke, a renowned stage actor and director, receives an offer to direct a production of Uncle Vanya at a theatre festival in Hiroshima. There, he meets a taciturn young woman assigned by the festival to chauffeur him in his beloved Red Saab 900. As the production's premiere approaches, tensions mount among the cast and crew. Forced to confront painful truths raised from his past, Yusuke begins, with the help of his driver, to face the haunting mysteries his wife left behind. So David, listeners who caught up with our London Film Festival dispatches probably heard about this film a few times because we spoke about it a couple of times through those. But let's start from the start. Could you give us a very quick intro to who Ryosuke Hamaguchi is and why we should be excited for this film?
Yeah, I'll certainly try. I mean, he's someone I encountered in around, I think it was 2015, And it was for his, I think, third or fourth feature. It's a film called Happy Hour, which is, I mean, if you think this movie is epic, then that one is, this Happy Hour is, I think, runs for 5.5 hours. So, yeah, it's this kind of epic soap opera. And I think that the thing that sort of characterizes his films that I've noticed, because I've seen every one since then, is that he is kind of very comfortable with having these quite lengthy dialogue exchanges and passages that are kind of really engrossing and quite kind of philosophical in that kind of Eric Rohmer style. And he's got this kind of preoccupation with I guess like performance. It's like the idea of like, when we're interacting with people, are we kind of performing, are we acting, are we kind of offering a kind of persona or a version of ourselves rather than something that's honest and true. And I think that's come up in all his films since, and yeah, very much at the core of this movie too. It's a film that takes the Murakami short story, I think what's fascinating about this film as a kind of literary adaptation is that when I watch an adaptation of a novel I love, I'm always kind of like thinking, oh, they've had to cut that bit out and they've had to squeeze that and truncate that, and it's kind of, you know, they've sort of drawn out the essence of the book but they've not really got it. And what he's done with this is the opposite, and it works amazingly well. Is he's taken quite a curt short story which runs to about like 25 pages and sort of spun it out into a 3-hour movie, and which means that he's not only able to sort of include everything in the short story, but he's also able to sort of fill it out with lots of other, you know, take ideas and sort of spin them out in new directions. So I guess without even talking about what the film is, for me, it's an incredible and, you know, sort of almost sort of like, film that you should like teach, use as a sort of teaching aid version of a sort of literary adaptation.
Yeah, this is amazing. As you say, Happy Hour, several hours long. This one, a mere 3 hours, adapted from a short story. Lillian, is it worth the 3 hours time sitting in the cinema to watch this?
Yeah, definitely. In fact, I often think that, you know, a film should either be, what, 90 minutes or it should be 3 hours. It's the in-between stuff that I find a bit a bit difficult. I think when you know a film's going to be 3 hours, you're sort of, you're there for the full runtime. And it's interesting, David, mentioning Rohmer's films, because I think that it's very clear that Hamaguchi is sort of inspired by a lot of post-Nouvelle Vague films. The filmmaker that I always think of when I see Hamaguchi's films is Jacques Rivette, and in particular Out One, which has these incredibly long sequences of theatre rehearsals, quite sort of experimental theatre rehearsals, and watching people just sort of play with performance and letting those sequences play out in full. And there's a lot of that in Happy Hour. Happy Hour, one of the first sequences is sort of people doing these sort of trust exercises in a sort of theatre space. And much of Drive My Car is about auditioning and then rehearsing for a production of Uncle Vanya, which has been done before. Vanya on 42nd Street by Louis Mao, another sort of post-Nouvelle Vague director, did a similar thing. And I think there's something great about Chekhov as ripe material for this kind of film, is because Chekhov, plays when they were adapted by Konstantin Stanislavski, were using method acting and sort of redefining performance. And I think that Hamaguchi does that. He allows people to just sort of exist in the world and follows their conversations and their, without it ever feeling boring. You know, there's not sort of languorous pillow shots like Ozu. It's very much sort of, there's always something to sort of stimulate, and I think that's just incredibly refreshing and rewarding to watch when we get a lot of Marvel films and so on.
Well, we should say that this production of Uncle Vanya at the heart of this film is a multilingual production, which is not something I was aware of in theatre outside of this film, so it was all blowing my mind and new to me. So you'd they would be cast and then rehearse with the actors having a language barrier, not overcoming that language barrier. So you may have Korean or Chinese, Japanese actors. One of the actors is performing in sign language.
Yeah.
And in a film that was at 90 minutes, to pick your other perfect runtime, Lillian, just that stage production would just be something in the background. It would be the reason to have all the characters together. But over 3 hours, it does allow us to really luxuriate in the practice of casting, rehearsal, all the way through to the final performance, and get across this quite unique approach to performance, drama, theatre, which we focus so much on. Communication, verbal communication through, you know, comprehension of language. Once you take that away and instead you're reacting to people based on body language or the rhythm of a scene, there's something really, you know, really, you know, profound seeing that play out in front of our eyes. And that shows how this is a 3 hour long film. I saw this at the London Film Festival, I think in the same week that I caught up with No Time to Die, the week before seeing Eternals. So two films that were in the sort of 2 hours 30 to 2 hours 45 runtime that were crammed with plot and incident and characters. And we've talked about those films before, whether they use that runtime well. There were think pieces about should we be allowing films to be at this sort of bum-numbing length at the cinema. And Drive My Car is such a full meal of a film. Because alongside that, we do have the character study of the director and his driver, and his backstory and the issues that he's working through from his life. But within that, it seems so, I'm going to say, generous on Hamaguchi's part to give us such an insight into the practice of this drama. David, the length for you, of course, shorter than Happy Hour, longer than his previous film, Asako 1 and 2, but the right length for you?
Yeah, I think that we should. I think I want to emphasize. Like, I totally agree with everything Lillian said and all those reference points. And that, you know, I think that this film is. I mean, Hamaguchi, when you read interviews with him, he definitely is a kind of hardcore cinephile, and he's, you know, he knows the kind of canonical filmmakers. And I think that this film is kind of, or in fact, all his films aspire to kind of like mingle with those. With those cats. And but actually, like, I think maybe it's worth saying that don't let that maybe scare you, and don't feel that you maybe have to like engaged with a load of other cinema to sort of get, kind of glean enjoyment from this, because I think that in the same way as like Murakami, it's actually kind of in its essence quite a simple film, and it's just about kind of people talking about feelings and revealing things about themselves and opening up secrets at different moments. And like in terms of like a drama and the through line of the drama, it's kind of very incident heavy in a way, even though those incidents are quite kind of subtle at times, like someone revealing something about themselves and how that affects that person. The length definitely wasn't an issue for me, and I think when you go in, you know prepare yourself. It's go to the bathroom beforehand, because it's definitely one where like you really have to kind of luxuriate in the nuance and really like, you know, engage with what people are saying, because it's one of those things where even though the dialogue scenes are really lengthy, everything people are saying is quite important, and it matters, and it comes back, and it's everything is kind of interconnected. There's no real kind of just wasted dialogue. There's nothing that's incidental. Everything, you know, it's a very, very kind of tightly packed 3 hours, and things lead to other things. So, and I think that boldness as well to just let these scenes run and to let these interactions kind of play out in a way that kind of is almost in some occasions like real time it's just such it's just what makes Hamaguchi for me one of the best working directors today. On a kind of slightly silly note, just to sort of bring some funsies into this in case it is sounding a bit serious, I was doing some research about the lead actor, Hidetoshi Nishijima. I probably have mangled that completely, but I've got a friend whose wife is Japanese, and he'd seen Drive My Car, and we were kind of doing a bit of a back and forth over email, because we both love the film. And in fact, his name's Trevor Johnston. He's actually interviewed Hamaguchi for Little White Lies. So anyway, his wife sent him back all these YouTube links of Nishijima's very, very storied and quite large career in TV advertising for detergent. And it's very bizarre seeing this incredible, stern, stoic, very kind of cloistered performance in the film. And if you go onto YouTube and put his name in, there are like hundreds of ads of him doing like toilet cleaners and kitchen detergents and stuff like that. And it's kind of incredible to think that he's taken that leap.
Well, that is quite the footnote.
Yes.
for Drive My Car, Dave. I suppose that is something when we do watch films from around the world, we're sometimes finding these actors just as we are presented with them in the film, so they may have detergent-filled backstories for all we know. But let's put some scores on Drive My Car then. David, I'll come to you first. In anticipation, enjoyment in retrospect.
I think I'd give it the same as I give it in the magazine, which is a 5.45. I do think it's an incredible film, one of the year's best, and I think that like the actual kind of process of watching it can at times be, you know, it's not like the easiest film to sit through. I was definitely feeling that I kind of, you know, I'd love to watch it again. Am I going to find another 3 hours to watch it again? But then at the end, in consideration, I was like, yes, I definitely want to watch this again. So, it's kind of like, I think I definitely kind of felt that like there was more to it than I was maybe getting while watching it.
Mm. Lillian?
Yeah, I think I'd probably go with the same as David. It's definitely one that I want to revisit at some point. I think what's so powerful about Hamaguchi's films is, as you were saying, about all these different sort of dialects and languages, and the sign language in particular. There's a scene in a sort of forest clearing, which is pretty much entirely silent, which is just stunning. And I think that you could almost turn the subtitles off on this film and still find those performances incredibly powerful and enriching. It's like when you go and see a play and someone's performing in sign language, you might not be able to understand what the words are, but the ability to emote of the actors in this film is incredibly powerful. And as David said, you know, I was throwing a lot of references around, and yeah, that's there, but absolutely, this is a film that I think you could feel incredibly enriched by, just by sort of sitting there and letting it take you on its 3 hour journey. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I loved this film, and it landed at just the right time for me. I was really prepared to be taken on a journey and be, you know, sit back in the back seat and let Hamaguchi drive for 3 hours, and I took so much from this. So I'd probably give this actually maybe a 4.54. I was a big fan of his previous films, Happy Hour in Osaka 1 and 2, and I can't wait to watch it again to sort of confirm whether it's a 5 in retrospect. I should also say, not only is Drive My Car out this weekend, but anyone within spitting distance of London can go and see the previously unscreened early films of Ryusuke Hamaguchi. Ross McDonnell has programmed a series of those films, finally got the rights to show them in the UK at the Close-Up Cinema in East London, which is such a treat for those people who live near London, unlike me. First and foremost, we recommend you go and see Drive My Car.
Also worth mentioning, Michael, that Hamaguchi has another film out in, I believe, February, which is also amazing.
I haven't had a chance to watch Wheel of Fortune and Fantasy yet, but that's a... Would we call that a diptych?
It's a triptych.
A triptych.
It's three short stories, and the third short story is maybe the best thing he's done, I think.
Well, that is a question for us and for listeners to mull over. What filmmakers have made great films at short, feature, and super feature length, as it sounds like Hamaguchi has in his time. But listeners, that is Drive My Car. Do seek it out this weekend. Up next, we have another film that's been hotly tipped from the festival circuit, Petite Maman.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
After the death of her beloved grandmother, 8-year-old Nellie meets a strangely familiar girl her own age in the woods. Instantly forming a connection with this mysterious new friend, Nellie embarks on a fantastical journey of discovery which helps her come to terms with this newfound loss. So Lillian, please set this one up for us. This is Celine Sciamma's latest film. Her last film was Portrait of a Lady on Fire. What should we expect with Petite Maman?
Just pure joy, I suppose. It is. Celine Sciamma has always been fascinated with children. Her first film, Water Lilies, in 2007, was the first film that she did with Adele Aynel, and it's a really stunning film about sort of queer awakening in young women. And then she made a film called Tomboy, which is a brilliant study of sort of gender identity in children and how that can be fluid, and how people of older generations might respond to that, and how kids are pretty open to these things and willing to accept others in a more sort of empathetic way. Sciamma is someone who absolutely believes that everyone should live as their authentic selves and never be judged for anything. She's an incredibly empathetic and warm filmmaker who I was honoured to be able to speak to for the new issue. And I sort of told her how much her films had meant to me, and that they sort of teach you that queerness is something that doesn't have to be sort of concrete or labelled. And I hope some of that came through in the interview that I did with her. And this film is quite different for her. I'd probably describe it as her least sort of overtly queer film. It's certainly more about relationships between mother and daughter. I mean, it's literally about that, but it is actually sort of a sci-fi film in some ways, which is quite different for her. There is this sort of what's so beautiful about this film is that there's this sort of strange time travel element to it, which is never explained or explored. You know, this isn't Ghostbusters. There's no need to sort of throw some high-tech language and made-up words around. It's just that childlike acceptance of the way things are is just, oh, there is my mother standing in this clearing in a forest, and I'm going to introduce myself to her and make friends. And it's just divine to be able to watch these two amazing child actresses, Josephine and Gabrielle Sons, work with really quite complex material that Sciamma has written for them. And it's just moving and powerful and perfect.
And it's so funny that we're talking about this film the same week as Drive My Car. This film is over 100 minutes shorter than Drive My Car. It's barely over an hour in length. It's quite a short feature. And I suppose in a similar way to Drive My Car, what is Celine Sciamma doing with that short runtime? Because it's quite a perfectly formed film, in my opinion. What do you think, Lillian?
Yeah, it is. I think that the reason why it's so short is so that you can just watch it over and over again. I was sent the link to watch this film to review it, I think I watched it three times back to back, which you know, makes it about the same length as Drive My Car, because every time I rewatched it, I spotted something else, and these incredibly subtle details. Celine was telling me that all of the artifacts in the film are from her own life, and things that her grandmother had, things that her mother had, things from her own childhood. It's a very personal film in a way that perhaps she hasn't tried before. And you know, you stop the cameras when you've told your story. For Hamaguchi, that can be after 5.5 hours or 3 hours, and for Sciamma, in this case, it can be 71 minutes. I respect that. I don't like films which have sort of very, very clear round run times, because they've clearly sort of added some things in to make it run that long. There's the freedom of independent cinema that you can just sort of stop it when you want to.
And it's another film that you can put on and really let it envelop you. Mm. It's such a good autumnal feel in the woods with these children. So unassuming in a way, but then powerful in moments. It's just a perfect example of using the heightened metaphors of science fiction or fantasy, but not needing to then go in the hard sci-fi direction of explaining things away too much, but to get to the heart of what can be profound and wise when you get with something like a time travel conceit like this. David, what did you make of Petite Maman?
Yeah, I really liked it. I think I maybe run a little bit hot and cold on Celine Sciamma, but like when I love her, I think I really loved her earlier films, Tomboy and Water Lilies, and was maybe a little bit less taken by Girlhood and I know Sacrilege, Portrait of a Lady on Fire, and I also loved her little. She wrote an incredible animated film called My Life as a Courgette, which I believe we covered on the pod way back when. But I think yeah, for all the reasons that Lillian said, she is this kind of vital talent and someone whose films I'm extremely interested in and seeing what she does. For this film, so another sort of bit of sideline story bit, that my daughter, my sort of 3-year-old daughter, is at the moment completely obsessed with the film My Neighbor Totoro by Hayao Miyazaki, and watching Petite Maman, it was very difficult for me to kind of differentiate the two, because I think they're so similar. I pretty much watch My Neighbor Totoro now like every other day in full, so I'm sort of picking up all these tiny little things in that film that are kind of, and I'm thinking, oh, that's a bit like Petite Maman. And there's all these suggestions about the adult characters and them seeing themselves in the younger characters, and this is kind of what Petite Maman is about. Like it's like a very simple conceit of like, I mean, it's a film about empathy and actually trying to sort of do something that is kind of psychological and poetic, not necessarily kind of boringly rigorous. It's not, I don't think it's trying to sort of like give you a kind of answer about, you know, child psychology, but I think it's just trying to say something and delve into a child's mind in this kind of very poetic way, and looking at how they might interact with a version of their mother who is like the same age as them. I think the other thing I love about this film, and you know, sometimes it is kind of the result of you know, low budget or wanting to make something kind of quickly and urgently, is as you say, it's like it's dealing in genre in a very kind of playful way and looking beyond things like, you know, I think even something as subtle as having some kind of like signifier that there has been some kind of temporal remove, that, you know, that things have slightly changed when she goes out into the forest, would have ruined the film for me. Anything that kind of like tells you what's happening and like it, you know, basically kind of underlines the magic of the film, just would have completely killed it. Because I think what Sciamma does is sort of acknowledges the fact that kind of, you know, a cut, like the most kind of rudimentary form of film grammar, is time travel. You know, it's moving between one place and the other, or one time and another. And it's like, why could you not just use that and kind of, you know, and in a way you're kind of challenging the viewer a bit and actually getting them to sort of engage with what you're doing and saying, in a way that you wouldn't do if you're just kind of telling them, okay, X has gone here and there's been a change, so watch out, guys. It's a delightful film, and yeah, it does have that kind of live action My Neighbor Totoro energy to it.
Yeah, in a good way. I think the Miyazaki connection you're drawing there is not only one that Celine Sciamma herself draws. It is a very good way of characterizing this film. It does have that sense of the spirit and imagination of a child, and how there is a wisdom and profundity within that, and she does make this film at the level of taking those kids' perspectives seriously in the way that Miyazaki did. Let's put some scores on Petite Maman. Lillian, I'll come to you first.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that Celine did say in the interview that she'd love someone to make this as an anime, or someone like Miyazaki to animate it. She'd love to make more animated films like My Life is a Courgette, but apparently it takes too long. I mean, I'm a massive Sciamma film as far as I'm concerned. All of her films are five-star masterpieces, and this is no exception. Fives across the board from me.
David?
I really like this. I'd probably give it fours across the board.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to give this fours across the board with the hope of rewatching it three times in a row like you did, Lillian, and maybe bumping that up to a five. And listeners, if this film intrigues you, do go out and check out My Life as a Courgette. That's a really wonderful animation. And also go back to the beginning of Celine Sciamma's films. I think that this does reach back to the likes of Water Lilies and Tomboy. If you've only seen Portrait of a Lady on Fire, there's so much to be discovered in her filmography. Listeners, that was Petite Maman out this week, along with Drive My Car. What a wonderful weekend at the pictures. Let us know if you see either of those, or both of those, if you have the time. And let us know what you make of them at the usual channels, at LWLies on Twitter, or truthandmovies at tcolondon.com. Up next, we have Film Club. And before Afterlife, there was a little film called Ghostbusters. In case you don't know the setup of Ghostbusters, the clue is in the title. Here is a synopsis. After a team of scientists, Harold Ramis, Dan Aykroyd, Bill Murray, lose their cushy positions at a university in New York City, they decide to become Ghostbusters to wage high-tech battle with the supernatural for money. They stumble upon a gateway to another dimension, a doorway that will release evil upon the city, and the Ghostbusters must now save New York from complete destruction. So, Ghostbusters, what a long and winding road. So many paths we can take about this storied film. David, are you of the age that you might have seen this quite close to release? When did you see Ghostbusters?
Not quite, but it was definitely one that I had taped off the TV and would watch in kind of half an hour increments every morning before school. And yeah, definitely kind of hit. I think probably the version that I had taped off the TV had some of the kind of swears dubbed out, or so it was a more kind of family version of it. But rewatching this again this week was definitely a kind of big nostalgia hit to my very early youth.
In a good way, or in a nostalgia's not quite it used to be way?
Well, I think it's a fascinating film, and like, I think it's one that is, I like like seeing it again now with my kind of pretentious film critic hat on. I think that I think the first half of it is very, very fun and funny. Mm-hmm. And then the second half, where we have to have this kind of story bit, like where it's all about the end of the world and monsters coming from another dimension to sort of cut, you know, blow up New York or whatever it is, it gets very tiresome for me. I mean, I think that looking at the history of the film, it's quite kind of, I think a lot of people blame it for a lot of bad things. I don't know if you ever, like, you know, it's that thing of like, can you blame a film for other bad films that have been made in its image? So like, this was like one of the first, if not the first, big budget comedy movies. Like, it was like a comedy movie that was that cost like over, I think it was like $30 million, which in 84 was pretty kind of massive. And I think there was certainly a sense when they were making it that they didn't really know what they would do it, like what they had their hands on, and were quite surprised when it turned into this kind of 300 million mega hit at the box office. But then it definitely kind of, if you look at the history of like big budget comedy, it's kind of littered with some of the most awful, reprehensible films ever made, I think. And so, like, I think that there's part of me that kind of thinks the Ghostbusters legacy has a lot to answer for. Not least its own. I mean, another sort of strand of inquiry entirely, but like its own toxic fandom as well, of people who are kind of ultra nostalgic for it as a kind of like emblem of youth.
It is really interesting, and as you say. Well, if you're like me and you believe that one of Bill Murray's great performances was as a guest on the David Letterman show across many decades, there's a fascinating pair of interviews that he does with David Letterman I guess it's 1984, where it's just before Ghostbusters comes out and just after it's ruled the box office. And beforehand, David Letterman's like, what is this Ghostbusters thing? And Bill Murray's kind of confused and doesn't really know how to sell it. And afterwards, they're saying, this Ghostbusters thing was quite big, and here's the merchandise, and they've got it on your face on a mug and things like that. So it really is just like the start of something, and they didn't know what they had on their hands. Because for me, Ghostbusters is akin to Star Wars and Back to the Future, films that are created by very particular creative minds, and then was maybe perhaps spun into franchises that went beyond that and turned into something different. When I watch Ghostbusters now, I can just really see the DNA strands of the fact that these are people who moved to New York, so they're adopted New Yorkers, looking at the city around them and being wowed by the history, the psychogeography, if you want to be that way inclined, of the world around them. Also the fact that Dan Aykroyd actually does believe in the paranormal and believes in ghosts, so all that stuff he actually does bring to that. And even though it's the mumbo jumbo, it's actually very strongly felt there. But Bill Murray bringing his loose comedy, Harold Ramis bringing a bit more of the heightened sort of stylized comedy as well. There's a lot in there which is bottling creative, you could call it genius, but certainly creative inspiration at a certain point in careers that would then, only 5 years later with Ghostbusters 2, become something very different, and the industry around it has changed. But we're the old guys with the nostalgia. Lillian, did you watch Ghostbusters growing up? Was this a first watch for you? What did you make of it?
No, I definitely watched it repeatedly growing up. And actually, I think I'm probably one of the last people who would be able to share that sort of memory of rewatching a tattered VHS tape that had been recorded off the television. We had both Ghostbusters and Ghostbusters 2 on it, and I would just sort of rewind it and rewatch it with the little lines going across. And as David said, I think it probably had some of the jokes missing. I'm pretty sure that it didn't have the dickless joke, which is one of the best jokes in the film, I remember seeing when I rewatched the film in 2016, having not seen it for a long time before Paul Feig's version, which I personally quite enjoyed. I rewatched that again ahead of this, and I think that actually as far as sort of a sort of spin-off remake type thing goes, that was quite fun, mainly because I love Bridesmaids, and I think that Bridesmaids with ghosts was kind of a fun concept. But yeah, as David said, there's been an awful lot of sort of films made in its model that are truly reprehensible. The one I was thinking of when you were talking, David, was RIPD, which is basically the same format, which is one of the most dire films I've ever sort of sat through. There was a misspent New Year's Eve when I decided to watch that. But yeah, no, Ghostbusters is fine. The first half is very good. It's not as good as I remember it being as a child, thinking it was really funny and very silly. I mean, it is silly, but Rick Moranis is great. We don't have long to talk about this film, but I just want to say that, you know, there's only a sort of a handful of Rick Moranis performances, and this one is great, and he's also great in Ghostbusters 2.
I found myself actually laughing harder this time at Rick Moranis and actually Harold Ramis as well.
Yeah, definitely.
Harold Ramis is really, really funny.
They're like definitely the best two. Yeah, and then you've got like Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd trying to be the funny guys, and it's like you're not quite as good.
But there's also this whole, I mean, we don't have time to get into it now, but there is this, like, I think that Ghostbusters has also been kind of drawn into this whole academic world of, like, as an example of kind of Reaganite economics done right. I mean, this is all kind of, if you look on the Wikipedia page, it's all there, but like, it's kind of quite, you know, it's quite obvious from watching that it's a film that is celebrating private enterprise in a way. I mean, one of my all-time favorite films is Paul Verhoeven's RoboCop. An amazing film about why private enterprise is a very, very bad thing, and this is its kind of like evil twin. This is its kind of like evil opposite. It's the film that is saying actually private enterprise is amazing. We need these guys to be doing this stuff. Otherwise, we're all going to be ruined, basically. So. I'm like, I think you have to either pick RoboCop or Ghostbusters. You can't have them both, politically speaking.
That's one hell of a take, David Jenkins. We want to end on. There are so many things we could say about Ghostbusters. My favourite trivia tidbit about it, very quickly, is the fact that Huey Lewis, the year before, of course, Huey Lewis made bank off Back to the Future with the Power of Love, also made money off the Ghostbusters theme, because they originally asked him to compose the theme tune and then went with Ray Parker Jr. He sued them for plagiarism, because the bass line was very similar to, well, the synth bass line was very similar to the Huey Lewis the News song, I Want a New Drug. And I'd go and listen to both those songs side by side, and you'll see the case that he was making.
Yeah, it does sound like a Huey Lewis song.
I did actually think listening to the song play out of over the end, the Ray Parker Jr. song, I was like, this is actually a really great song, like from a technical standpoint.
Yeah.
But why did Ray Parker Jr. have no other career from it? And you've just answered that question.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, there you go. Listeners, I'm sure you have some thoughts about Ghostbusters, and maybe if you see Ghostbusters Afterlife, you'll have some thoughts about that as well. Please let us know at the usual channels, at LW Lies on Twitter, truthandmovies at tcolondon.com. David, Lillian, thank you for joining me. This has been such a pleasure talking through the films this week with you. Up next, we have Ridley Scott's House of Gucci, the debut film from Reggie Yates, Pirates. And since House of Gucci is in cinemas, we're going to go back to one of Ridley Scott's very divisive recent films, The Counselor. Listeners, please subscribe wherever you pod. And if your podcast player of choice lets you leave reviews, we'd love you to leave one for us too. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Truth and Movies is a Little Dot Studios production for Little White Lies. Truth and Movies is hosted by me, Michael Leader, and my guests this week were David Jenkins and Lillian Crawford. The podcast is produced by Jake Cunningham and Harold McShiel, and edited by Steph Watts and James Payne.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. Their meditations range to fit your needs each day, from anxiety and stress, relaxation and focus, to building habits and taking care of your physical well-being. They even have expert-led talks on topics such as tips for overcoming stress and anxiety, handling grief, improving self-esteem, caring for relationships, and more. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.